Welcome back to The How, Channeling Water Solutions, a podcast from W12 Plus program. The How focuses on water solutions and the people behind them from around the world. In this third season, we are excited to bring to you a series of 6 episodes highlighting locally led organizations and their work in water, sanitation, and hygiene across Ethiopia, Ghana, and Uganda.
Each episode brings a story of a local organization and its people. The stories highlight pressing water challenges in their communities and how these locally led organizations are addressing them. They are locally led, community-driven water solutions.
I'm your host, Kajal.
And I'm your host, Anna.
Anna, in this episode, you spoke with Agnes Merembe, the Executive Director for Action for Rural Women's Empowerment, ARUWE.
That's right. Madam Agnes is a phenomenal woman who not only shares the story of ARUWE, but also shares her story and relationship with water while growing up in Uganda. ARUWE is a locally led nonprofit in Kampala, Uganda. ARUWE works in areas of sustainable resource management, climate smart agriculture, women's economic justice, sexual and reproductive health, education, and climate change.
Thanks, Anna. Let's listen in and learn more about Action for Rural Women's Empowerment.
Thank you for joining me today. And would you please introduce yourself?
Thank you so much. My name is Agnes Merembe, and I am the team lead at Action for Rural Women's Empowerment, as you've said. So I'm very excited and happy to be here.
Thank you. And could you give us a little bit of a background on your experience in WASH and what got you involved in working in water?
For me, growing up, back then, so many years ago in my village, I think the socialization and growing up in my village, the role to really collect water, to make sure that the household has water, is our role as women. And so as growing up, I was seeing me and my sister, together with my mom, it was one of our biggest roles to ensure that the household has water. And that time, because the water sources were really far, and if you really wanted to get a water, safe water, you needed to move a distance. And we could take, in a day, I remember clearly, we could take about, you know, between 45 minutes and an hour in search for water. Mm-hmm. And that was a role that we could do, say, for example, waking up very early in the morning before going to school, you needed to make sure that you have water because water is basic for everything. And so we had to move before going to school. And so that meant that you lost some out because we could find some of our friends, our learners already started, you know, started in class. But for mm-hmm. you have to come home. I mean, you have to reach late. And so that for me, I saw that as growing up, water was central. But because of our socially, and I should say socially constructed norms in that time in Uganda and our area, mm-hmm. We had to go through a lot of challenges to access the water, and it affected me really. And so I really got motivated. And I remember clearly that as we were getting the water, the boys were doing other, you know, I felt simpler, you know, roles. And so we did not have a lot of time really to say, for example, to play as children. I could not see my mother also concentrate on other social development activities because we could collect the water before going to school, but also coming back home. That was the first thing to do because you needed water for housework. You needed water for the animals because we used to rear animals. So that for me, I grew up really, really, really experiencing the burdens of searching for water, and access was really a challenge. And so growing up and, you know, when I got an opportunity to study, I knew for sure that the burden of water for women is a big issue that really affected our social development activities. And that's when I got an opportunity to study, I thought that having, you know, a course that would really come back to benefit the women and also, say, for example, ease in terms of social development activities, and that is one of it is access to WASH. Mm-hmm. I thought that that would actually really fulfill me as a person because of the challenges that I went through growing up accessing mm-hmm. water. So that motivated me into the programs that you're implementing at Sarowe.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well, it sounds like this journey of yours is, it's deeply personal.
It's really personal.
And how did you find yourself working with Arue and coming to the, I guess, realization that working within a nonprofit, developing a nonprofit was the way to go compared to working in a government sector or in education?
So I was very intentional, like I said, having gone through the challenges, I was very intentional, even deciding the course that I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to have, you know, a community development program, but so much working with children and girls, because that is what I saw, and that is how it really affected me. And so getting an opportunity to work with Arue, first of all, has given me fulfillment of living my dream as a person, because it's an organization, first of all, it's a women-focused organization, and that's actually, we target children and women in all programming. But it also comes in to bridge the gender gaps. As you can see clearly in my story, the difference between the roles that the boys were doing and what we're really doing, it's really in terms of women, it took away all the time that we had because of the socially constructed, you know, roles, and it would not really allow us to participate in other development process. And so for me, when I went with Arue, because it's really an organization that comes in to bridge that gender gap in, not only in WASH, but also other social development activities. And I should say that the niche is really to strengthen the leadership of women, so that the women collectively can really come up and challenge the different challenges they go through, including access to water. Mm-hmm. And so we try as much as possible to empower the women and girls, first of all, to initiate, but also manage their social development processes. And these are, we use four strategies. One of them is community participation. And so with Arue, we give an opportunity, because in my growing up, because of a male-dominated society, I mean, culture, the men do not allow, and we are seeing this in the communities that we are working with, even with access to water. Men, because it's a male-dominated community, we do not so much have access to, you know, issues of control. We don't control a lot of assets. You can find in a community where even it's a water source, but, you know, governance and control is mainly dominated by women, by men. Mm-hmm. And so we don't get opportunities to participate in decision-making. We don't own, and we don't get opportunity to be in spaces because of the care role challenges that I told you, but also because of the time poverty, because we are so much into, you know, issues of looking for water, you know, now access to firewood, you find that the women don't have, you know, that opportunity. And so as a role, we think that we can give an opportunity to also women to participate in all these processes by participating, as we say, but gender mainstreaming very key, because we really want them also to come into the center play. And then if there's opportunities for service delivery where, for example, improving access probably for water, if we partner with other organizations that can come in to support service delivery, we also use that as a strategy. And lastly, advocacy, mm-hmm. Really building their capacities around understanding. And we use a rights-based approach, helping them to understand really that it's their right to access water. And if the government is not, you know, doing what it's supposed to do, so we build their capacities around advocating for, you know, improved services, including WASH facilities. So Arue gives me that opportunity to, first of all, really achieve my vision, mm-hmm. because we have a shared vision, making sure that the women and girls mm-hmm. can really, you know, really enjoy their full potential. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why. Yeah.
And as Arue, mm-hmm. you do work across Uganda. You have kind of projects going on all over the country. How do you approach a community and engage around the topic of gender? Mm-hmm. How do you start that?
It's very difficult, I should say. The fact that I should say that the patriarchy system and the male dominancy, at first I should share for sure that before most of the communities that we are working with, when you talk about gender, mm-hmm. Especially the elders, especially the people who are in key positions, mostly are men. And so they felt like it's a perception. They think for sure that you're coming into, you know, probably, I should say, take away that autonomous, that mm-hmm. authority away from the men. And so it's usually very difficult because of the culture, you know, norms where they think that it's just about men. I mean, men should control, men should influence. And so the practice, what we usually do is we try as much as possible as we get into the community, first of all, to make men allies. Mm-hmm. You want them to really understand that it is not because it's making sure that there's gender, you know, equality, gender balance, gender equity, and it's not taking away the powers that they have. And so we have learned through experience that the approach should really have the men, first of all, understand. And so we bring them into also sessions of really understanding what gender mainstreaming is about, and not taking away the powers, but really trying to make sure that the women also have, you know, equal platform. Or say, for example, women can also engage in the spaces where they can also contribute to, you know, gender-responsive programming, mm-hmm. such that we can all, men and women, girls and boys, can benefit. So that's what is really helping. So there's a lot of gender sensitization mm-hmm. trainings that are happening. And so we actually have to, first of all, work with the leaders themselves for them to appreciate and understand that building, you know, helping the women also understand and the men understand that we can really have social, you know, transformation, economic transformation, if there's gender balance is very key. So we have them on board, train them as well, mm-hmm. as we also let the ladies understand that it is about, you know, making sure that they can also have spaces where they can air out their opinions and appreciated in spaces where they can also, you know, be listened to. So we try as much as possible to use gender transformative mm-hmm. approaches and to have that ground level. But I should say that it's still not so simple in some communities, but mm-hmm. that's how we approach it. Yeah.
Definitely. I mean, with gender at the center of your work, it's really cool and interesting to see all of the projects that you have been able to accomplish with that gender-focused lens and the trickle-down effect on how that impacts girls' access to menstrual hygiene products and awareness, as well as education and moving things forward. Mm-hmm. But what are some of the biggest water-related challenges that you're seeing across your communities that you're working in? Mm.
I should say that access to safe water at national level stands at 67% in rural areas, mm-hmm. just 67%. And that is, I should say, 67%, but sometimes when you get into other villages, and that's an average, it's lower. Mm-hmm. In urban places, it's 72%. But in terms of equity, there's an issue with equity because at least the government has tried as much as possible. At least 80% of all villages have at least one safe water. But you can imagine a village has over 1,000 people, mm-hmm. and at least they are trying. So in terms of the issues of access is still a challenge. Mm-hmm. And not only access, but equity in allocating these water sources. So it means for sure, and it hasn't changed because it is a role of women and girls to ensure that it's water, and that is that community. So it means for sure that the women are still going to invest, and I don't want to say waste, because when you say wasting, it means the time that it's wasting, but we are investing a lot of time still to move the distances to access the water. And this means that it's going to really, really affect on our time. And that's why the women still have issues of time poverty, because making sure that you take all that you move that journey in the morning, in the evening. And I said, we need water for everything we do. So you find that the woman is really spending a lot of time to access the safe water. That time that would be invested in association, mm-hmm. participating in other social development activities. But without water, basically, for us, we cannot. Most of the things really, you know, are based on water. And so access, the distances, and besides, it's also, I should say for sure, that it, say, for example, in the schools where we are working with, mm-hmm. if a school does not have safe water in the school premise, it means that children will still, and that's the practice. It means that if the school, that class that is collecting water in a day will have to waste that water. Mm-hmm. But it also, without water, the issues of menstrual hygiene management are very challenging. And that's why we saw in the studies we did before that in Nebbi, where we have worked in some of the schools, We looked at the completion rates in some mm-hmm. of the schools that we worked. And for the girls, it was only 6% completion rate at primary level. And some of the issues that what the girls were saying, why they drop off, is because they do not have access to that. Because most of the girls use reusable, mm-hmm. you know, pads. And you have to have water to make sure that you're clean. And so without that, it affects the retention, first of all. They can be enrolled, as you saw, big numbers. And it's true, we have seen classes at lower level. For example, the girls can be in a class under maybe 120, but in P7, only 20 or 15. And so if there is no water, that will really affect the girls in terms of menstrual hygiene management. So issues of retention, issues of academic attainment, because definitely, the stress that they go through. But we've also had cases of safeguarding mm-hmm. issues where in some areas where we are working, girls report and say they're abused on the way. Mm-hmm. It may not be sexual abuse, but the boys and, you know, the way the communication, the way they touch them, because they really walk a long distance to get to the community water source. So all those issues really affect, you know, the social, you know, development of mm-hmm. the girl. And I should also say issues of hand washing. Mm-hmm. We had, you know, the recent COVID issue. Without hand water to really wash our hands, issues of, you know, such diseases cannot be controlled. Besides, you know, as children in communities, if there is no hand washing, even if it's a viral infection, flus and all that, the increase in prevalence is really high. So that's one of the challenges that we are seeing. So issues of access, distance, equity, and I should also say issues of technology. Mm-hmm. We are working in northwest, maybe it's in northwest, mm-hmm. and that's one of the areas where the regions that we are implementing in. But you find that sometimes the terrain, the geographical, you know, the geographical area mm-hmm. may not allow some technologies, and you're working with a partner, and some of these technologies are really costly. Mm-hmm. Excavating a borehole, and if the terrain cannot really, you know, permit, say, for example, a shallow well, and you do not have that kind of money, mm-hmm. it means that society cannot be served. So the technologies also is really an issue. But besides, we are talking about women and girls. Some technologies are not really gender sensitive. Mm-hmm. We have girls who are disabled, for example. And so if the pump does not cater, puts into consideration the gender issues, mm-hmm. and that's why I say gender responsiveness, it means that, you know, that disabled girl may not be able to really, you know, access that pump and, you know, access water. So all those things are really still a big challenge. I should say, in terms of also the last one, I think costs financing. Mm-hmm. It's a big challenge because the government itself, and unfortunately, I should tell you that our budget, our sector, but as a country, has declined a bit mm-hmm. in terms of water sector. So the government is also limited in terms of making sure that every village can have, you know, water. And that's why I said they are trying to see at least 80% of a village at least has just one safe water. So issues of finances are still a big challenge. And before you come, I think I shouldn't sustainability, mm-hmm. operations. So we are trying, and the government is trying, but even in their budgets, a lot, I think I should say, I think it's about 50% of the cost goes into the facility infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And some reports actually say just 1% into operations and maintenance. Mm-hmm. And so we also have issues around making sure that the facilities can be sustainable to serve the next future. Mm-hmm. And so you're trying to build just a borehole, but if you do not put into a good sustainability plan, if you do not really make sure that the communities own and understand the operations and maintenance, you find that most of the facilities will break down if you don't put. And that's also still a big challenge in terms of, you know, access to water.
What is the average length of time that the government infrastructure lasts in a community?
Yeah, that's a difficult one, because if there's no good operation and maintenance, a borehole can even break down in 3 months,
okay,
which can serve for even 10 years if it's really well maintained. Yeah. So the issue is, I mean, the other factors also matter, mm-hmm. so matter. And so if there's no, for example, a good committee that is trained, and when I say, and I think that also takes us to governance, the governance of WASH, where women sometimes are not actually brought on board. Because for the case studies that we have seen, are committees that have given opportunities to women also serve. Mm-hmm. Most of the water source is really well, you know, maintained and sustained, yeah, because the women appreciate and they know that if we don't look after this very well, the burden is going to be on our side. So it's a number of factors. Mm-hmm. If there is a good system that is built within the community, a water source can serve.
Okay.
You know, a number of years. Mm-hmm. Without that in place, unfortunately it can even break down in less than a year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so with the government infrastructure around funding and finance for these projects kind of decreasing, what is your organization's experience in being able to access international funding or bigger funding schemes to be able to continue the work that you're doing? Mm-hmm.
We are trying as much as possible to partner with and to collaborate and to resource mobilize. That's mm-hmm. very difficult, and especially in a funding landscape where funds are also deteriorating, right? Mm-hmm. And so, but we have had luck with some of the partners that we are working with who come through, and that's why I say that one of the strategies we are using to really empower community service, improving on service delivery, that is the government role, but we come in as supplements. And so mm-hmm. when we happen to get partners that come in to support the programming, then we work with the community. First of all, demand-driven approach, where the community really approaches and say, we really have this, you know, issue with water. And so we design together the intervention, and then we come in to, you know, execute that program. Mm-hmm. Improve on the water sources, agree on what technology we'll use, also putting into the fact of finances, as we've seen, because different technologies. But when the partner comes on board, we'll support, we work together, but also in partnership with the local government, because they also have different roles. But we have also really worked with, you know, say for example, we have partnered with other like-minded organizations, because it's about financing, it's about the government, and so advocacy. And so we are members of UWASNET. UWASNET is an umbrella organization in Uganda that actually oversees all NGOs that are implementing WASH. And so we come together in that network, and so we lobby, we advocate for improved, you know, budget allocations. Mm-hmm. It's hard, but that's what we are doing. So that kind of, you know, lobbying and advocating, using, you know, evidence-based, you know, research, and letting government really understand that the communities have issues with accessing water, and also helping government understand that without safe water, it also affects other indicators of, you know, development. So we are doing a lot of advocacy with, you know, under our those, you know, consortiums, other umbrella organizations, to ensure that more funds are devoted towards the wash sector.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And as we've seen with things involved with climate change and the impacts of climate change, we know that climate change is impacting marginalized groups far more than those that are more well-off and also within lesser developed countries. So are you experiencing or seeing anything? Are community members that you're working with talking about the impacts of climate change and how that is impacting them and their access to water?
Oh, sure, yes. There's a very big, impact now that we are seeing in communities and the intersectionality between water, climate and other sectors is very evident. While I mentioned initially that it's a gender, it's a women's role to make sure that there is water, it's also women's, most culture, most societies, it's also a women's role. The culture has defined it. It's just constructed that women, it's our role to make sure that our households have access to energy.
Okay.
Access to reliable a source of energy. And unfortunately, what we are using mainly, I think I should say 80% of the population uses biogas. And that means we are going to cut trees because that is majorly the main source of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And so this woman here, because most of the women do not know and are not aware of alternatives, say, for example, most of the rural communities that we are working with cannot access the national grid.
Okay.
They are really, really cutting down the trees to make sure that they can have energy for, you know, for their households, cooking, not lighting, but I mean, warming us and all that. So that has really affected on the environment. And without trees, I mean, the rainfall has been really affected. And I should say also the other practices that if they're not trained, they're really having, say, for example, agricultural practices that are not, you know, friendly to the ecosystem. And that has also just, you know, intensified the climate change the challenges. And so we are seeing now long droughts.
Yeah.
Long droughts affecting our food production.
Mm-hmm.
And when the long droughts happen, there's not going to be enough food. Without enough food, without nutritious, you know, nutrition on the table, it will affect our performance as, you know, mothers, because the children will not have enough food. But I should also say that the Uganda is, I mean, the small-scale farmers feed the country.
Okay.
And so if the, there's no, if the rain doesn't come on time, and that is what we are seeing, where you expect rain, it doesn't come. It takes long to come. And when the rain comes, there's a lot of floods.
Mm-hmm.
And that means it will also wash away the food. And so that also affects food security.
Yeah.
Climate change has come in to affect food security. Climate change has also affected, you know, a lot to do with the food, water, because the water table will definitely go down.
Yeah.
If you cut the trees, that's why we get sometimes to do surveys to excavate water. At first, the survey will show a presence of water, but then you go and excavate, you drill twice, and there's no water.
Yeah.
So it means the water table will actually also be affected. And the issues of, I should say, high population also.
Mm-hmm.
I think in Uganda, we have a high fertility rate.
Mm-hmm.
And so the population has increased.
Mm-hmm.
And so you find that also when we increase the population, the resources are not, you know, so that's why you're seeing that these activities, if women are not, you know, are trained, if the communities are not trained, they also activities that we do also have an effect on climate change.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what, those are some of the things that we are seeing now happening in the communities that have really affected, and most especially the mothers, the girls, the women. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's lovely to see Arue kind of tackling these challenges in a really co-beneficial way. You're not just hitting one topic and leaving it at that. You're really trying to create a full circle. You're hitting things along climate change, agricultural sustainability, and supporting women and girls, and kind of changing how people go about their day-to-day lives and recognizing these impacts of climate change, they're going to be impacting them for years to come. And you're taking all these things into account. And as we kind of wrap up our time together, I have just kind of one final question for you. Can you share any upcoming projects, events, or ways for our audience to get involved with your work or support the initiatives that you're working on?
Yes, I should say for a fact that the need for safe water in communities is still a lot. And like I said, for sure, that our governments are limited by finances, which is really one of the biggest challenges we see. And so for us to keep, and I should say for us to keep, especially girls in schools, we need a sexual mold. You know, we want to have other partners come on board. And that's why we think a multi-sectoral approach is the best approach to really approaching this. While the government is failing, I think we really need people elsewhere to understand that if we do not tackle this, it's going to affect other factors. Say, for example, attainment to education, the maternal health without water. So we want to encourage other, you know, partners in terms of, you know, making sure that they support and making sure that the funding is accessible for local, small indigenous organizations, you know, like Arue, because sometimes also accessing funding may be very difficult. But we just want to make sure that that funding, you know, that is bringing on board gender responsive approach can be accessed to organizations like Arue to support and to ensure that, you know, children are supported to have access to water in school, such that they can stay in school, we can retain them, and we make sure that they can really finish and complete to go in other levels. So we are calling upon, we would love partnerships, we would like collaborations, and for us to implement and to make sure that the communities that we are serving can reduce on the issues of access to safe water. So we one of the things I think is collaboration, partnership, and if there's opportunities to accessing funding, financing, we would really appreciate.
Okay. Wonderful. Is there anything else that you'd like to share with us today that we didn't cover?
Yes, I should say that we try as much as possible to bridge the gap. But I must call upon everyone to really come on board, because the need is still big. The need is still, the gap is still wide, and especially issues of equity. So as Arue comes in to work, we are just, because of limited funding, we are just working in small, you know, a few districts. Yet the need, like I said, for access to safe water, access to sanitation is still big. So we just want the communities to understand that as we contribute to bridging these gender gaps in the water sector, I think we want more partnerships. We really call upon partnerships to make sure that we have access to financing to make a difference, to improve, to change livelihoods, women livelihoods, and girls. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Agnes, and thank you for being here with us today. I will open it up to questions from the audience, excuse me, if there are any.
Possible for women's
inclusion
to get water otherwise,
they
need some support.
That
is not convenient for them.
Yeah. And just to repeat that in case we use this for audio, this was a comment on mentioning how the accessibility and usability of something like a borehole is not always thought about for women, those with disabilities, and those less able to actually have the strength and power to be able to use it. So with that, oh yes, one more.
I'm wondering if you have specific goals that you want to focus on over the next year or 2 years. Is there like an area, a specific thing you want to really capitalize on over the next year?
Yes,
and to repeat the question, one question from the audience is, are there specific goals or specific areas that you would really like to focus on in the coming years, to 2 years?
Yes, I think inclusion, dignity, and equity in WASH sector, to ensure that as we implement these programs, there's really equity in allocation. And so there's really need to make sure that as we implement, if funding comes through, we would like to make sure that access to water is improved, especially among schools, primary schools, secondary schools, but also at community, because we found out that children spend a lot of time, and for them to stay in school, there should be water. And so that's one of the things that we want to have, but also the goal of making sure that climate adaptation, mitigation in what we are doing, because we have learned for sure that if we are to improve just water facilities and don't also really build the capacities of, you know, the communities, the children to understand how to adapt, how to conserve the environment, it may become very difficult. And lastly, I think governance around WASH facilities, making sure that the women can also occupy those spaces. For them, first of all, to decide what technologies would work for them. For them also to decide in terms of allocation, because we have seen men take the spaces and they're not into, you know, fetching the water. So we'd like the women to be part, to be included in participating, but also owning and controlling some of these, you know, facilities put in place. So having women participate in WASH governance is something that, so building their capacity. We want to have women, not only as end users, but also, you know, we can have women mentors to also participate in constructing, maintenance, and those are some of the goals that we want to have, yeah.
Right, thank you, Agnes, and thank you, Arue, for all of the work that you are doing.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Of course. Yeah.
More information on this locally led organization can be found in the podcast description, including their social media handles. Thank you for joining us.